which sort of originated in 2001 with my advisor, Samir Mathur. But I also want to at least, it sort of naturally engages in some of the recent ideas about firewalls, the whole firewall argument for black holes. So what I've put up here are just some nice review articles about the fuzzball proposal by different groups, and so they each have sort of a different emphasis or point of view about what the fuzzball proposal is and how we should think about it. So Mathur has two review articles that are a bit more sort of conceptual and really focusing just on the two charge solutions, which is where really all began. Baena and Warner have a review article mostly focusing on finding supergravity solutions, in particular, you know, three charge and higher charge solutions. Skinderis and Marika Taylor have a review article, and they are more focusing on the connections between the fuzzball program and ADS-CFT and how those two ideas sort of work together. And finally, Balasubramanian et al. So Balasubramanian, Jan de Boer, Cheryl Schock, and Messema, they mostly focus more on, so in particular, they look at like geometric quantization and sort of the role, if you can think of the black hole solution as some coarse-grained average of fuzzballs. Finally, Samir has FAQ on his website, which might address some questions or concerns that you have. Okay, so that's out of the way. So my rough plan for these three lectures is today. So I'll do a bit of an introduction and talk about, you know, what is the fuzzball proposal. And there are sort of disagreements about some aspects of that. And then I'll try and give some very general or abstract motivations for why you might believe something like this. Because at least some people find it to be quite a radical idea. So that's probably going to be take me through today, at least. then the next time I want to talk about more concretely how fuzzballs arise in string theory. And this is where we get sort of the more concrete evidence, and this is really where the ideas sort of began. So it's sort of, I'm sort of going in reverse chronological order. So it's not, maybe not the most conventional presentation, but hopefully it'll work. And so in particular, I'll talk about, you know, how these ideas relate to ADS-CFT and so on. And at the end, I don't expect to spend a whole day on this, but so probably this will extend over more than one sort of open questions and problems. Okay. All right. So and then just before I really begin, you know, please ask questions, and also please let me know if there's some particular aspect that you would like me to focus on more in the following lectures, if you want, you know, more technical details or something like that. Okay. So I'm just going to start sort of at the very beginning. So black holes. So black holes, you know, have sort of these some puzzles or problems associated with them. So, you know, we can think about everyone's favorite black hole, which is the 3 plus 1 dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. And you know, it has a horizon at r equals 2gm, and sort of in a singularity at r equals 0, okay, in some in the usual coordinates. So you can see that, for instance, by looking at this kind of curvature invariant. I forget the name of it, but it has a name. And so sort of in a cartoon, we can think of it as there's some singularity, and then there's a horizon sort of outside of it. More precisely, people like to look at sort of the causal structure by looking at a Penrose diagram, which I'll draw for some like collapsing matter. So I'm only going to do the one-sided case. And then there's a horizon here, so you can see that explicitly in the causal structure. Okay. So this is sort of the classical picture of a black hole in general relativity, but of course we know that's not the whole story. So as Bekenstein and then Hawking really showed, that black holes are really thermodynamic objects, so they have an entropy proportional to the area, and a temperature, meaning they radiate like a black body, which of course for Schwarzschild is one over the mass. And so eventually, you know, if I start with some initial configuration of matter, it'll eventually radiate away. And so usually people sort of alter their Penrose diagram to look like this to reflect that ultimate fate. Okay. But this all comes from sort of semi-classical considerations by looking at sort of quantum fields on this background. But you know, what about quantum gravity effects? So there's sort of a natural length scale that associated with quantum gravity, which would be the Planck length. And so this seems to be the natural length scale associated with quantum gravity. And for instance, if you consider graviton-graviton scattering, when the center of mass energy is like 1 over the Planck length, then that's when you really have quantum gravity effects. Okay. So from just sort of this kind of dimensional reasoning, you might expect there's sort of quantum corrections to this picture, or in general in gravity, when the curvature in some sense is like 1 over the Planck length squared. So for like our 3 plus 1 dimensional Schwarzschild, that would mean like the radius is, say, order m to the 1/3, which in particular is much, much less than the horizon. Okay. For a large mass black hole, it's parametrically smaller. So I can sort of imagine any sort of quantum effects to be sort of centered around the singularity. And so this would be sort of a traditional view of, a black hole with quantum correction. So let's see if I get this just. That was not very helpful. No? Okay. Okay. So there's sort of a problem. So there are a few problems or questions that come up with this kind of picture. So the first, of course, is the most famous, which is the information paradox. Uh, which I'll talk about a little more later today, I hope. But you know, basically, if you start with some smooth configuration of matter on a flat background, then it can collapse and form a black hole, which radiates like a black body away until I just have radiation again on flat space. And since you know, I expect that there's a limit where I can just talk about quantum fields on a smooth background. You know, I can do quantum field theory calculations like at the LHC, and I don't have to worry about quantum gravity effects. And so, you know, in flat space with smooth matter, I should be in that regime. So I could have some initial state. So I have some initial matter. Which should be in some initial state, quantum state psi. And then at the end, you know, if I look at sort of Hawking's argument for the nature of the radiation, it looks like in the final state, I'm just left with radiation, again on some background with the low curvature. But it's described by a density matrix. And it's pretty close to thermal, it looks like. Okay, so there are sort of two problems that sort of signal the loss of unitarity here. So one problem is that I started with a pure state and it evolved to a density matrix with non-zero entropy. And the other sort of loss of unitarity is the fact that this final state is basically independent of the initial state. So there's sort of two tightly connected ways in which unitarity has been lost, or you can say information has been lost. So that's the information paradox. That's the problem with black holes that most people are familiar with. But there's sort of a related question, which we could call the entropy puzzle. So remember, you know, Bekenstein gave these abstract arguments that the entropy should be proportional to the area of the black hole. And then once Hawking computed the temperature, it fixed the constant in front. But usually, you know, if we have an entropy, we imagine it's counting some states, you know, that engraved on Boltzmann's gravestone, that its entropy is k log omega, or k log w, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and the black hole is a microscopic object. So, the people who worry about the fact, you know, consider the possibility that somehow unitarity is not lost, but somehow that we're making a transition where we don't need it, but you're somehow collapsing the wave function.
I'm not sure you want to say that we're collapsing the wave function. I mean, so there's two related points. So one point is, for any sort of macroscopic process, you know, you can't really, you know, if I burn a piece of paper, I can't really tell, you know, if the final state was really a unitary transformation of the initial state, or if it's just a thermal density matrix. Like, you know, in practice, I'm this big, dumb macroscopic observable, and so I just coarse grain over stuff, and I lose all that information. So there's a question of, you know, in practice, could I do such an experiment to measure the loss of unitarity? So the information paradox is really a question of, in principle, you know, is the final state a unitary transformation of the initial state or not? Then there's sort of a second question. Let's see, you were asking. Sorry, did that address your...
No, I mean, I know about that argument.
Okay.
But it's really the second one where, you know, in everyday life, in quantum mechanical experiments, we're used to somehow, when we make an observation. There's the unitary evolution kind of comes to an end at some point, or which is why I use the word the collapse of the way you should. So I was just wondering here,
well, I mean, I think at least I'm going to take the point of view that, that nature is fundamentally quantum and that the classical description is emergent. And so if I sort of have an isolated system, it evolves unitarily regardless of how big it is. Maybe you'll disagree with that, but that's the point of view I'm going to take. Yeah.
Here you present the story from the point of view of matter. But could you elaborate a bit more if you take into account gravity? I mean, you have, let's say, if I take into account gravity, matter is not really coupled to gravity because I have to solve the Hamiltonian constraint.
You have to solve, sorry?
The Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah.
Matter states is fundamentally always entangled with gravity states.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the matter states, you would mean that you're tracing out the gravity between the two, right?
True.
Okay. In that case,
I will make this a little sharper.
Okay.
But also, part. Yes, but on the other hand, I know that I can do quantum field theory calculations without worrying about, entanglement with geometric quantities. For instance, doing calculations for the LHC, they seem to work very well. And it's true, but what I tried to do is argue that in the initial state and the final state, I should be in a regime where that kind of approximation should be valid.
You mean the entanglement of gravity is negligible? Is there any evidence for that?
I think that's all I have to say right now about.
You're assuming that the entanglement with matter and gravity is negligible in the final state.
I'm assuming that as the final state, I can treat essentially as radiation in flat space, and so I expect that I don't have to worry about the kind of concern you're raising. But yeah, I mean, let me keep going, and then. We can talk more later, or I might sort of partially address some of your concerns, or might not, I don't know. So there is another problem, though, or another question you can ask, which is, if I interpret this entropy as sort of real statistical physical entropy, then where are all these microstates? It's sort of weird to associate an entropy to a classical solution. If I think about StatMech, I have, if I think about like a box of gas, there's a classical phase space that I can think about, and there's sort of a correspondence principle that says I can break it up into Planck size scale cells, and then I can imagine that the entropy is sort of counting those cells. But I don't seem to see any classical phase space for the black hole. There are various, sort of relatedly, there are various no-hair results, which suggest that, there aren't really any small perturbations around the black hole. Anything I try and do to deform it just sort of exponentially dies down. And so, you can ask, what how do I think about the microstate? So one possibility would be you could just imagine that all the microstates don't have, you know, a classical limit. So they all look like the black hole classically. And so in some sense, they're just associated with, you know, whatever quantum gravity effects we just argued should be near the singularity. But, you know, then that seems a little weird because I have a huge number of states sort of in the seemingly small volume in some sense, loosely speaking. And, you know, I can start worrying about, you know, whether that's going to give me the kinds of problems that remnants do or, you know, just, it just seems a little strange, but it's not a sharp contradiction. Okay. So that's the entropy puzzle, which is just where are the microstates or what are they? And then the third question, which of course has been on a lot of people's minds lately, is what happens when you fall into a black hole? So certainly within classical GR, it looks like you just fall right through the horizon and then you get torn apart near the singularity. So there's a question, you know, whether that story changes once, you know, you include some quantum effects, or, you know, if I'm going to assume throughout my talks that quantum gravity is actually a unitary theory, so once I include that fact, does that imply, you know, that there's a firewall or something like that? So with that in mind, let me just sort of try and define what the fuzzball proposal is. And I'll try and mention that there are some points which people sort of have different points of view on. So I think what everyone agrees on, more or less, is that within the fuzzball community, is that first of all, I should take the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy literally. So the black hole has some e to the s microstates. And then the microstates have the following properties. So one, we usually say that they're smooth solutions, so they don't have a singularity of the type that like the Schwarzschild black hole has. They might have singularities which will be associated with stringy sources, but that's okay. Okay. So they'll be smooth, and in that sense, and they'll be horizon free, so they won't have a horizon, and they won't have an entropy associated with them. So this is nice because usually I don't, you know, almost by definition, a microstate does not have an entropy. And then the second point is that they have non-trivial structure. Up to so they have non-trivial structure that differs from each other and the original black hole solution up to the would-be horizon. So the idea is that I replace, you know, that kind of picture of the black hole, right, with, you know, a picture where I just have some kinds of microstates, which extend up to where I thought, up to at least, you know, maybe a bit past where I thought the horizon would be. Okay, and then each of these microstates will be differing from, you know, they'll be differing from each other on that same scale. Yes, that's a bit awkward, but you know, basically, what I can say is that you know, if I start from infinity, the solution ends, the space-time ends, basically before I hit the horizon. And if I try and sort of make loose estimates about the scale at which that occurs with respect to sort of the sort of flat space, with, you know, as someone at infinity might try and measure it or estimate it, it seems sort of comparable. I don't have a precise definition. I can show you when I get to it. I'll show you for like the two charge solution a little bit more explicitly what I mean, or the sense in which that's true. Yes? Yeah, so I was about to come to that.
Before we get to that,
yes.
I think you said the geometry of the space-time ends. Did you really mean that, or did you mean the agreement between your microstate and the black hole?
Well, in a certain sense, space-time does end, and not in a singular way. Rough. I mean the same way, like the Euclidean black hole cigar geometry ends, for instance. Yeah.
But this is happening at r equals r.
Roughly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Can you draw a space-time diagram?
What do you mean by a?
I
could, but it wouldn't be very interesting. Because, I mean, if you want to think about the causal structure, you know, as soon as I don't, if I try and erase the singularity, then I don't know how I can have a horizon without a singularity. But basically, what I'll just end up with is more or less just flat space type conformal diagram, because it's not very enlightening to, in that sense. Next time when I write down some explicit solutions, it might be a little clearer. So, for instance, with a two-charge case, what you have is these sort of strings of KK monopole. And so, you know, a cycle pinches off right there. Anyway, we'll get to it. Right, okay, so this definition, as one of you is already pointing out, is kind of problematic, because part of the idea of the fuzzball program is that this is sort of supposed to be some sort of quantum effect. And so what does it really mean to say smooth and horizon free if I'm talking about sort of quantum gravity? It doesn't seem to be that well defined. So then it becomes useful to distinguish between two slightly different versions of the fuzzball proposal, which Baena and Warner, for instance, term sort of the strong version and the weak version. So the strong version would be that there's a classical phase space associated with these microstates. And so then you can talk about these classical solutions within, for example, supergravity. And so that classical phase space will have the properties of being smooth and horizon free, which is not to say that the actual microstates for the black hole are classical. The sort of weak version would be just to say, well, the typical sort of microstates are not going to have a nice classical limit. So this first point is I'll just sort of strike off, and I'll just really emphasize the fact that the microstates will have structure up to past the horizon, where I thought the horizon would be, naively. So looking at infinity, you know, if I sort of looked at my asymptotic charges and then thought about sort of the traditional black hole solution, before, you know, maybe just before I hit the horizon, I'll hit some stringy sources, or space-time will sort of pinch off. So whether which version is true for a general black hole is sort of a matter of debate within the community. I'll mostly just be focusing on sort of this weaker version. The strong version is a bit more precise, so it's a bit more, you know, it's easier to sort of prove correct or incorrect. So, you know, people are even just looking at the three charge extremal black hole, there's a question of whether or not we're going to find enough phase space within supergravity to account for the entropy of the black hole. So it's an open question. Yeah. Right.
Which is some standard procedure.
Yeah, usually we think about geometric quantization. Sorry, what do you mean?
You're starting from microstates, and then
yeah.
You're talking about structure at the horizon.
Yeah.
Which doesn't, you know, there's no horizon.
Right, there's,
horizon.
Yeah.
So you're imagining some way of extracting a geometry?
Well, I guess I'm imagining if I sort of looked at infinity, you know, I'd measure sort of the mass and charges of the black hole, and then I'd sort of write down my usual black hole solution and say, there's a horizon at some radius. So if I fall in for so long, then I'll be passing through the horizon. And the claim is that when I actually would try and do that, I would actually hit some structure associated with these microstates. Yes. I think what you're asking, so part of this, the Fuzzball program, is the idea that sort of the traditional black hole solution arises as an effective description from some sort of averaging over the microstates. And there are all sorts of questions about whether, you know, what sort of measure you would use for that, and what sorts of what sorts of processes would you need to consider to see that you have actually some fuzzball versus the traditional black hole solution. So all of these are sort of open questions. There's been a lot of work on it, but nothing conclusive, I would say. So that was one of the sort of points I wanted to make, was that there's some questions or different points of view about what role the original black hole solution plays. You know, what do you use it for? And you know, for people that aren't in the fuzzball community but are maybe slightly convinced by some of the arguments, they might speculate, well, something like this is true for only the extremal black holes, the supersymmetric black holes, but it won't continue to hold for non-extremal. So that would be sort of another different point of view. So I'll try and return to some of these points later. Okay, so once I have, if this were true, then it almost automatically resolves the information paradox. Because basically I have, you know, information that's not, you know, behind any sort of event horizon. And so, you know, the black hole can just radiate the same way anything else in the world radiates, you know, like a piece of coal. Just fluctuations just leave locally from, you know, the surface, and they carry the information about the initial state in some very delicate correlations. Okay, so now let me play with the chalkboards. Okay. So one question you might ask is, what happened to dimensional analysis? So we had just argued that, you know, when the curvature is order, you know, Planck scale, that's when I should expect, you know, sort of quantum corrections. But I want to attribute these microstates in some sense to some quantum effects. You know, if I think about like a collapsing shell of matter, it has to somehow get into these kinds of microstates. So what happened to that kind of dimensional analysis? And the point is, the Planck length is obviously the right length scale to think about if you're talking about graviton-graviton scattering. But when I'm thinking about the black hole, I could think about another length scale, because I could take the mass over the Planck mass to some power, for instance. And I could think of this loosely as like number of particles. And so just as a plausibility argument, I can suggest that you know, there's this other dimensionless parameter, so I can dimensional analysis at least doesn't have to completely banish this kind of argument. And I should just mention that, you know, this isn't completely unprecedented. If you think about Bose-Einstein condensate, for instance, the sort of thermal wavelength associated with the individual particles is, you know, which you might naively think is sort of the quantum effects, the scale of quantum effects, gets sort of enhanced when you have all these particles, and instead of lambda t, you have n out to some power alpha, where n is like the number of particles. I forget the exact. Yeah.
We're trying to model like high entropy.
That's true. That's a good point, and no. But maybe you'd be happier then with his second argument that Mathur advanced a few years ago. If I think about tunneling, so as we know, you know, the amplitude to tunnel between two states is exponentially suppressed by the action, basically. And I can estimate thinking about the black hole, I can estimate the amplitude to tunnel, and it basically comes out to e to the minus s, where s is the entropy. On the other hand, if I think of the number of different states that I'm claiming you can tunnel into, then that's supposed to be e to the s. So you could at least roughly argue that, you know, these two things might sort of cancel. And so that even though, you know, it looks like the sort of amplitude of tunnel between any given two states would be very small, there's so many different things to tunnel to that the two effects sort of cancel out. And so this would be sort of a peculiar property of black holes, because, you know, it's only with black holes that I have such a huge entropy available. So loosely, I think you could say that the saddle point approximation is breaking down because of the measure in the path integral. This isn't supposed to be like really super convincing. It's just sort of plausibility arguments right now. So the other question is, if I think about a non-extremal black hole, what keeps these putative microstates from collapsing? So this is another obvious question you might want to ask. Of course, within general relativity, there are lots of arguments that you can't have stable configurations of reasonable matter below, like, was it like 9/4 the Schwarzschild radius? So how am I going to evade those kinds of constraints? So I should point out that first of all, the sort of microstates, microstates of the black hole, even though the black hole is spherically symmetric, the individual microstates I should not expect to be spherically symmetric. Yes. Uh-huh. I'm not sure. So I mean, I guess I'm mostly thinking in terms of like the strong version of the fuzzball proposal, which suggests that there's some classical phase space associated with these microstates. And so if there is such a classical phase space, then you can ask why don't they collapse within general relativity. It's true if I'm just thinking about the weak version, I don't have very solid arguments about that it should collapse or it shouldn't, unless I really have a better understanding of quantum gravity. So one point is that the microstates won't be spherically symmetric, and the other point was that the non-extremal geometries that we'd like to think of as some sort of microstates that we've made so far, none of them have a global time-like Killing vector, which is one of the prerequisites for that kind of theorem. So, again, it sort of evades that kind of argument. There's also one sort of physical mechanism within string theory that we can think about why this might work. And this is what has been called fractionation. And the idea is that string theory is a theory of sort of extended objects. And then when one looks at bound states of these objects, D-brains and fundamental strings and so on, they seem to get fractional degrees of freedom with fractional charge when you consider large numbers of them, and then they get sort of like they can get kind of big and floppy maybe. So if I think about like a fundamental string with a compact direction, so it has some winding charge and momentum charge. So whereas the energy levels of some graviton, you know, Kaluza Klein modes of some graviton or something, would be like integers over R, where R is the size of the compact direction. If I look at the multi-wound fundamental string, then of course it goes with 1 over the winding number. And if I think about like dualizing that to some D brain, then it suggests, you know, I get sort of like a fractional brain. With effective tension given by the usual tension over that winding charge. And so if the tension has gone down, then it sort of becomes sort of big and floppy in that sense. Okay. So that concludes my sort of plausibility arguments. So now I'd like to talk about sort of another reason, just from thinking about the information paradox, why you might expect structure on the horizon scale. And so this is what's been called Mathers' theorem. And I'm going to present a generalization of it that I made because, well, I like the I understand it better, and it's more general. And the generalization is important, actually. But so if we're thinking about Mathers' theorem, the sort of starting point is just by if we look at, you know, this curve that, you know, Page first sort of really introduced. If we think about the entanglement entropy of the radiation as a function of the dimension of the radiation Hilbert space, then Page argued that, you know, for sort of generic states in an appropriate sense, this is what I should expect. It should grow linearly and then fall linearly, with the sharpness here controlled by the size of the total Hilbert space. So initially, I don't have any radiation at all, so of course the entropy is zero. And in the final state, all I'm left with is radiation, so I'm assuming the evolution is unitary, so it also has to be zero at the end. So of course I should expect it to go up and come down. Okay. On the other hand, if I look at sort of what Hawking's calculation would suggest, it would actually suggest sort of a maximal violation of this, where for the first half it would basically agree, and then it would just continue to grow linearly until at the end I have some state with a large amount of entropy and nothing for it to be entangled with. And of course this is one statement of the information paradox. Now, so what a lot of people have thought is that, okay, black holes take a really long time to evaporate. Okay. You know, for a large black hole, it's order, you know, it's order m cubed. So, you know, it's significant compared to the, you know, age of the universe. So since, you know, I expect the information or the corrections that restore unitarity from this state to that state to be very delicate correlations between many, many particles. And since the evaporation time is so long, I might think that, you know, just small, say, non-perturbative corrections to Hawking's original calculation will sort of accumulate with time and sort of turn this curve into that curve. So Mathers' argument is an argument against that. So it's the claim is small corrections don't accumulate. So small corrections to Hawking So how did he argue that? Or how can we argue that? So what I can do is I can imagine what he introduced was sort of a simple qubit type model of the black hole evaporation process with discrete time evolution. Okay, so where did that come from? So basically, it came from starting by thinking about the so-called nice slicing of the black hole. So I take some particular space-like slicing, and I can do it in such a way that everywhere along the slice, the intrinsic curvature, the extrinsic curvature, the lapse and shift, and so on, are all much less than the Planck scale. And so in every way, it seems like I ought to be able to use quantum field theory, for instance, ordinary quantum field theory techniques with only small corrections. And so you think about evolution on these types of slices. So just sort of taking one slice at a time, you know, I have a horizon, the horizon somewhere, and then I have outside and inside. And the pair creation timescale is order of the mass of the black hole in Planck units, and the evaporation timescale is order m cubed. So that's like delta t. And so what I can imagine doing is I can just sort of truncate the dynamics to the lowest L mode, the L equals zero mode. And so that's a very physical thing, physically reasonable thing to do. And just think about sort of loosely thinking of qubits as zero representing no particle and one representing particle. So I'll go to some, I'll imagine that there's some sort of semi-localized description here. And this is made more precise in Mathur's paper on this, and also Steve Giddings has done had a paper sort of along these lines. and so I suppose I can break the total Hilbert space into a direct product of the internal space, which I'll put hats on everything, and the outside, which will just be the radiation. Well, so I just want to break it into two parts.
Yeah,
so
it's not possible because of the independent constraints. So that goes back to the division equation. The independent constraint is an elliptic equation. So on a slice, it's non local, which means you cannot break. That's the problem that people have in the numerical simulation.
Right.
So such a breaking doesn't really, initially, doesn't really exist. It exists on the kinematic parameter space before you solve the individual constraints, but on the physical parameter space, I'm not sure what you mean by breaking.
You know, I think the point is, you know, if I think about sort of this nice slice construction, then.
But I guess you're freezing all gravitational degrees.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. But
I mean, what'll what?
Essentially, might come from gravity.
Right.
So that's a distinction where gravity is unimportant.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with this nice slice construction, and then consider sort of general, very general corrections that I might have. to sort of the evolution I would expect. And so I would think that I could include sort of quantum gravity effects in some.
Depends. If you, in quantum gravity, what I think is that it's fundamentally non-local.
Right. I understand. Yes, and I don't.
Any correction which is going to be local correction is not going to incorporate the Hamiltonian constraint effect, unless you are doing something about it.
Okay, I'd love to talk about that more with you, but let me just continue. I don't have a strong rebuttal to. Okay. So if I think about the evolution I would expect on these sorts of slices from sort of Hawking's calculation, then what it looks like is that I just pull pairs of particles out of the vacuum at the horizon, each on the order of this time scale. And since they're being pulled out of the vacuum, they're always pulled out in this particular state. Which, because I'm thinking about sort of a low energy description to get to these qubits, it's just going to be this maximally entangled state, which I'll write like this. Okay. So that is to say there's sort of the state where no particle is produced inside and outside, and there's the state where a particle is produced inside and outside. Okay. So at each time, step, can I have another 5 minutes?
I'm happy with that.
Okay.
Sure, yeah. Keep going.
All right.
If people are getting hungry, the back
door. Okay. Yeah, so at each time step, this would be sort of my leading order expectation from thinking about putting Hawking's calculation in this kind of qubit language. So, I guess I don't actually need to erase yet. So, in my paper, what I was concerned about is it seems very puzzling because at each time step, I seem to be increasing the dimension of the Hilbert space by 2 qubits. So I already seem to be in trouble. And you know, physically, where that comes from is that new. You know, if I take a Hawking pair of particles and I trace it backward in time, then eventually, it looks increasingly blue shifted, and it looks it's going to escape above whatever cutoff I put on my theory. So I can think of these particles getting pulled out from the UV. But how, if I'm going to really work with these kinds of models, then what's the sort of interpretation of what a unitary model would look like in this? So my motivation I could sort of relate this kind of picture to, in quantum information theory, there's this idea of quantum operations, where there's an operator sum representation where you have a fixed dimensional Hilbert space, and then you also have sort of an environment coupling representation where you enlarge the Hilbert space to include some environment, which may or may not be physical, it could be sort of fictional. And so I'm thinking about sort of the extra degrees of freedom that I'm adding as just allowing a convenient parameterization of potentially non-unitary evolution. So that is to say, in this model, so I start with some physical Hilbert space corresponding to the black hole, which came from some initial matter. And then at some later time step, the Hilbert space is bigger. So I have the radiation, I have some new internal degrees of freedom, and then I have the original ones. And all of these are in some sense associated with the black hole. Okay, so the dimension of the Hilbert space is increased. But I'm going to call some of these auxiliary. And so if I want the state of the physical degrees of freedom, then I'll just trace out the auxiliary degrees of freedom. And then this should be the physical state of the system. And at the end of the evolution, the black hole should be entirely auxiliary, because unless there are remnants or something, there's just nothing there. And then I'm just left with the radiation. So final which is just all the black hole. Okay. So, yeah.
So this means that sort of the intermediate stages you're allowing your whole state, including what's on the inside, to evolve to the mixed state. Is that what this auxiliary system is doing? It's purifying the state?
Yeah, that's right. I can think of it as I have some fixed dimensional Hilbert space, which I'm evolving in a potentially non-unitary way. And so at each time step, I could imagine just purifying the state by adding some additional degrees of freedom.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding. I mean, you just assumed information loss.
Yes.
Okay.
The point is that if I want to make this kind of argument about small corrections to Hawking evaporation, then I have to work in a non-unitary framework, because otherwise I'm just assuming unitarity, which is I'm starting from non-unitary evolution. So the question is, is there sort of a unitary model which is just a perturbation away from this non-unitary model? So I have to work in a model space which allows non-unitary evolution.
What is the shaded region in the middle diagram?
So this is, just sort of a cartoon. So this is representing the Hilbert space associated with the black hole, which is what I have to start with. Then at this sort of intermediate step, I have created a bunch of Hawking pairs. Okay, so some of them escape to infinity, and those are the what I'll call the radiation. And then some of them are going, their mates are falling into the black hole. And so these are the new ones. Okay, and so the Hilbert space seems to have increased in size, but I'm saying any reasonable dynamics, even if it's not unitary, I would like to have a fixed dimensional Hilbert space. And so some of these must be auxiliary in this sense, so that I trace out the auxiliary degrees of freedom to get the physical state, okay, which may or may not be a pure state.
To put another way, you're writing the non-unitary evolution as unitary evolution after appealing to the church of the larger Hilbert space.
That's right. Yeah. That's basically right. So the evolution in this model, I'll write in the following way. I'll have the state. So by allowing myself to consider these auxiliary degrees of freedom, I'll just talk about pure states. And then, so psi I will be the state on the step I. And so I'll evolve by an isometry I on psi I. And so this isometry is going to correspond to the pair creation time step. And then I'll also allow, although it's not particularly interesting, unitary evolution among the internal degrees of freedom and the radiation degrees of freedom. And I'll call this psi I plus 1. So that's the state at the next step. Okay. And so, as I said, this is an isometry and not a unitary. So I want to, you know, I still want probability to make sense even if the evolution isn't unitary. So that means I have to preserve the norm. Okay, so that means that I dagger I is the identity. But this is going to have like a non-square matrix representation because it's increasing the Hilbert space. So the most general model that I could write, you know, a model in this language entails specifying the isometry at each time step, the internal and external evolution at each time step, and then the auxiliary space that I should trace out at each time step. Okay? An isometry in linear algebra is a mapping from one Hilbert space to a, in this case, a bigger Hilbert space that satisfies this condition.
Is it necessary to have that stuff? Could you not just begin by inventing your largest necessary Hilbert space from the get-go? You restricted yourself to the physical portion of it. And
yeah, I could. I could do that. Yes. The reason I don't do that is really to connect with the kind of language people use here. But yes, that's exactly right. I could do that. Yes.
So you're assuming a finite dimensional Hilbert space here.
Okay. Yes.
Because if you just allow yourself to have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, you're not that exotic. You know, then you need to.
I think it's reasonable to associate a finite dimensional Hilbert space if I, you know, put in an IR and UV cutoff and restrict myself to sort of the fixed energy surface, then I think I can allow myself that freedom. So. Okay, so Mather's key insight was that the marginal increase of the entanglement entropy of the radiation is a smooth function of the isometry I. Okay, so if I and sorry for the Hawking model. This is just I log 2. So if I think about just smoothly deforming the Hawking model, the marginal increase is log 2. And so I have to do a large deformation to get the entanglement entropy of the radiation to start decreasing. Okay. So it can't just be a small perturbation in this model space to restore unitarity. In my paper, I prove that statement. So this is some operator norm. So if this is true, where epsilon some small parameter, or just has to be less than 1 actually, then you can show that the marginal increase in the entanglement entropy of the radiation is log 2 minus some function of epsilon, which is parametrically small and positive. In fact, it's like minus epsilon log epsilon with some factor.
Do you mean delta SI Hawking?
Sorry?
Do you mean delta SI Hawking?
No, I'm just defining here what I mean by delta SI.
Right.
So I take the entanglement entropy of the radiation on the I plus 1 step and subtract the entanglement entropy of the I step. If the evolution is unitary, that has to become negative at some point.
The I and I log 2 is not step number.
That's the step.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of care.
So yeah, maybe I shouldn't have used I because you might think it's the imaginary unit, but. Yeah, maybe I should use N or something. And since I'm pretty much out of time, so this is sort of. Is an argument against the kind of picture that some people had about, you know, sort of small non-perturbative corrections restoring unitarity to Hawking's calculation. Okay. And so once, so this suggests there should be large corrections to the pair creation process, which you can interpret it as saying that at the horizon, it's not really in the vacuum, or there's some sort of structure or excitations there. So in that sense, it would be in support of the fuzzball proposal. So I, you know, this leads naturally into sort of the firewall argument, but I think I'll just, in the interest of time and lunch, I'll postpone that till next time. Yeah.
So we already touched upon the issue of whether or not you can break the Hilbert space up into interim and external pieces. Where does that enter into this statement here, precisely? I mean,
So I should be, should have defined that a little more precisely. Sorry. So one of the assumptions I made in proving this is that the isometry can be expanded in this form. So phi 1 through phi 4 are four basis states for the created pair. Okay, and then p 1, 2, 3, 4 are operators which I'm just going to allow to depend on the internal Hilbert space. That is to say, I'm going to allow the newly created pair to depend on the black hole in an arbitrary, on the state of the black hole in an arbitrary way. But I'm not going to allow the radiation which is left and is very far away to affect what pair is created. Okay. Yeah, if I just allow myself to do just sort of general transformations where the radiation that's left and is m cubed away to affect the newly created pair, then yes, then I could make small corrections in some sense work. But I don't really want to have such radical non-locality in my theory.
Is that not a weaker requirement than really the breaking up of the space?
Yeah, I kind of suspect that it's more of a technical, suspect that argument's sort of a deal breaker for this kind of argument, but it's worth thinking about more for sure.